In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we have with us political scientist Sarah Mitchell. She is the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Sarah, welcome to our program. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Chris Larimer is with us as well, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Chris, always nice to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
To start off, we're going to be talking about the election law bill that's making its way quickly through the Iowa legislature, and we invite our listeners to join us with comments or questions about that topic or any others this hour. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, why Tom Vilsack enjoys bipartisan support. He's just been confirmed again as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. Merrick Garland will be talking about him. He looks to be the new Attorney General of the United States. And also, we'll take stock of Biden's first month. It's been just over a month, and we have had this week the grim milestone of 500,000 U.S. COVID deaths. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about work in the Iowa legislature. Since it was introduced just last week, a wide-ranging election law bill has been rapidly taking steps to become law. Just yesterday, it passed the Iowa Senate. The bill would, among other things, reduce Election Day voting by an hour. All of Iowa's polls would close instead of at 9 p.m., 8 p.m. for all elections. This bill would create a stricter deadline for returning absentee ballots, shorten Iowa's early voting period by 9 days, taking it from 29 days to 20. Other measures in the bill. The Senate's approval of the bill came on a party line vote yesterday, 30-18, with every Republican in support, every Democrat opposed. The lengthy debate beforehand discussed voter fraud, voter suppression. Let's listen to a couple of the voices from that debate. Here is yesterday on the floor of the Iowa Senate, Republican Senator Jim Carlin of Sioux City argued that reforming Iowa's election laws is essential after the 2020 election because of voter fraud, and that nationwide millions of Republicans believe the last election was stolen.
Fraud is the worst kind of voter suppression. Fraud is. 77% of Republicans believe that there was fraud in this last election. Millions and millions and millions of people believe there was fraud. Most of us in my caucus and the Republican caucus believe the election was stolen. We saw changes in election laws weeks before the election that were not authorized by the Constitution, as what happened in Pennsylvania, where the deadlines for eligibility of ballots were changed, postmark requirements were taken off the table, and signature verification was no longer required. The wholesale purpose of those actions was to facilitate fraud. Fraud is voter suppression.
Okay. Jim Carlin, Iowa State Republican senator, echoing some of the words we've heard for many months from Donald Trump and some GOP leaders repeatedly spreading disinformation about the nation's election systems. Polls now showing that few Republican voters accept the election results were accurate. Let's listen to some more debate. This from the Iowa Senate yesterday on this election law reform bill. Senate Minority Leader Democrat Zach Walls of Coralville speaking about the rejections to amendments proposed by Democratic lawmakers and the speed this legislation is moving through the State House.
There is a lot of disagreement in our state about the 2020 election.
And there are a lot of people who believe that our legislature needs to do more to secure our elections because of what we just heard. And that is precisely why I am so disappointed in how this entire process has been handled. When Democrats and Republicans disagree on a piece of legislation, it sends a signal to the people of our state that the underlying issue is political or partisan. And that is precisely why it is so disappointing that the majority has rejected several amendments from Democrats that would have improved this bill and demonstrated bipartisan compromise to the people of our state. That is why it is so alarming that a bill that was written in secret without input from Democratic legislators was introduced just last week and is now being fast-tracked to the Iowa Senate. It's been said that it wants to be on the governor's desk tomorrow. What's the rush? Why aren't we taking the time to get this right? Why aren't we taking the time to forge a bipartisan compromise that can show the people of the state that Democrats and Republicans can agree when it comes to election security?
Senate Minority Leader Democrat Zach Walls of Coralville yesterday. Start us off, if you would, Chris. What do you see happening with this legislation? Why is it moving so quickly?
Well, I think in part it's moving quickly because it reflects, what you have when you have unified control of state government. We've seen this during this session and in the last few sessions when the Republican Party has had unified control. They've tried to push through a conservative agenda, and this elections bill fits with that. And so I think they're trying to push it through while they can because, there's a lot in here that's pretty controversial. That's going to turn a lot of heads and raise some serious concerns about the process of voting in Iowa and the way that it works. As you said, this has been a political issue. This has been driven by Donald Trump in terms of his claims about election fraud. There is not widespread election fraud in Iowa to my knowledge. And so for a lot of people, this seems to be, I think a lot of people are concerned by this bill because it comes across as a bill that's really searching for a problem where a problem really doesn't exist, that we don't see widespread voter fraud in Iowa. And so I think the reason it's being rushed through is because it's in part a political move. When you have power, and we see this with Democrats and Republicans everywhere, right? When you have unified control, you try to push through and finish whatever policy agenda you have. The issue here is it's a bill that's very widespread in terms of what it does for election and election law in Iowa, fundamentally reforms the way elections work in Iowa and the process leading up to election day in Iowa. But for a lot of people, they don't see the need for it, right? That we haven't had issues of really widespread voter fraud in the state.
Mm-hmm. Republicans arguing that this bill would create uniform election procedures across Iowa's 99 counties, strengthen the integrity of the elections in the state. Sarah Mitchell, do you see anything else going on here? Democrats would say so, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think they talk about fraud as the way of framing what they're doing, but that's not really the agenda, I think, in terms of the motivation. So compared to a year ago in February 2020, there are 106 bills now across 28 different states, I guess, right now. 106 bills this year versus 35 last year. So you can see that a lot of states with unified Republican control are trying to enact voter restriction bills. And in fact, 35 states have introduced 406 of these types of voter restriction bills. And there was an interesting study by Hajnal, Lajavardi, and Nielsen in Political Science Journal in 2017, where they looked at the effect of these voter restriction laws for a sample of over 50,000 voters in all states. And what they found is in states that enacted photo ID restrictions, Hispanic voting decreased by 7%, Black voting decreased by 4.5%, Asian American voting decreased by 5.4%, but white voting increased by 0.2%. And in particular, there's a really strong, it widens the white Latino voting gap significantly by as much as 10% when they enact these photo ID laws. So, if you know that those groups often support Democratic candidates, then of course you would have an incentive to enact these kind of restrictions that will increase turnout by voters that are likely to vote for the Republican Party and decrease turnout by voters who are likely to vote Democratic.
Join our conversation with political scientist Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. Karen is joining us from Des Moines, listening there in Des Moines. Karen, welcome to the program. Well, what do you have
Thank
to
you.
Chip in on this topic?
Well, I was been wondering, I think Paul Pate is in charge of election security here in Iowa, and I haven't heard anything from him on this law or anything. We had the voter ID law not just changed recently where he was wanting to reduce fraud, although he must admit that there isn't any. But what was his standpoint on the last election? Not heard anything about it.
Right. And to my recollection, late last year, Chris, Paul Pate was saying, countering the president then President Trump, saying this was a free and fair election in terms of Iowa, right?
Actually, Ben, I was not able to hear what Karen had to say. Would you mind summarizing that?
Karen, can you hear me now all right, Chris?
I can hear you. I just can't hear Karen.
She was asking about Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate, mm-hmm. What has been his role in this and why he has been keeping quiet to Karen's mind.
Oh, okay. Well, in part, what this bill is doing is cutting down on the use of absentee ballot requests, right? It's reforming how that process works. It's saying that the absentee ballot request can begin only 70 days before an election rather than 120. It's cutting down when they can be on the number of days in terms of when they can be received. We've heard Republicans talk about that they want to prevent what happened with county auditors in three counties last election cycle, where they were sending out pre-filled or pre-populated absentee ballot request form. But you have to remember, last year in the primary of last year, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate was really advocating, I believe, for sending out statewide ballot request forms to all Iowans in the midst of the pandemic to try to help increase turnout. And so I think that's why you're seeing a little bit of, maybe, I don't know if it's not silence, but you're not hearing as much from Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate's office, because in the past, his office has really pushed for sending out at least empty absentee ballot requests. And I think, to Sarah's point that she was talking about with the research, which is really important on what voter restriction or election reform bills can do to voter turnout among different segments within the population. You look at the reforms that are in this bill dealing with absentee ballot requests and the sending of those out and when absentee ballot requests can be received and how those timelines are being condensed considerably. We hear people who are in favor of this bill talking about, well, last year we had record voter turnout. Yes, but there's a very different way that Democrats and Republicans were voting. If you look at the turnout, at least using the Iowa Secretary of State's website, Democrats, 61% of their votes came through absentee ballots. The number is 44% for Republicans. And so even though there was record turnout, a portion of this bill is really targeting a means of voting that disproportionately Democrats were more likely to use in the 2020 election.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, I wonder if you could pick up on what Chris mentioned about the implications for county auditors in Iowa's 99 counties. It would prevent county auditors from mailing absentee ballot request forms to voters unless the voter asks for one, and also prevent them from setting up satellite voting sites unless petitioned. It would create new criminal charges for county auditors who disobey state rules. Comment on that part of the bill.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some legal cases, right, involving Johnson County and Linn County trying to, in terms of the absentee ballot requests that they sent out to all voters and whether those were valid or not. And so that was being heard in the courts last fall. And so that this bill is just following up on, what the GOP position was in those cases.
Mm-hmm. And those county auditors were making it easier to vote, encouraging voting, which that's something we expect from our county auditors, right?
Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, if we want to call ourselves a democracy, we have to protect the right to vote. And this is why you know, having a national voting act would be a good idea with Democratic unified control, right, at the national level. So I think the Democrats should definitely prioritize trying to put into place some kind of national voting rights act, because, you know, we have so many, you know, so much variance across the states in terms of how people register, when they can register, you know, when they can vote, what are the periods for early vote, do they have to have voter ID or not? All of these things vary across the states. And even within Iowa, I noticed that, you know, my parents' early voting procedure in Cerro Gordo County was, you know, was not as sophisticated as it was in Johnson County, right? So even within Iowa, we see that kind of variance. And so, and I was going to point out too that that voter restriction laws also reduce turnout among young voters. And we know from political science research that if you're an 18-year-old voter and you turn out to vote, you're way more likely to continue voting across your lifetime. And so these kind of restrictions also hurt, right, the recruitment of younger voters into to be excited about and participate in politics.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I'd like to have you comment on that little bit of floor debate we heard from Republican Senator, State Senator Jim Carlin of Sioux City, talking about this was necessary because I think he said 70% of Republican voters believe there is massive fraud. Now, he was careful to say that it's just a belief because this has been fostered, right? This is using a justification for a belief that is founded on nothing, that is untrue.
Yeah, to my knowledge, there's not, I have not seen or not heard of widespread voter fraud in Iowa, or that, you know, that there is widespread voter fraud across the country. But you're right, it is a belief, and it is something that has continued to come up in polls before the November 2020 election, and certainly after the November 2020 election. And that has been driven by former President Donald Trump and his discussion of the lead up to the 2020 election and the aftermath. And, you know, from a political science research perspective, this really shouldn't be all that surprising, in the sense that we know that voters take their cues from elites, from leading elected officials. And at the time in 2020, if you had the leading elected official talking about voter fraud, and we know how polarized the electorate has become across, you know, virtually all issues, that every single issue is really filtered through a partisan lens for those voters who are active in the political process, it really shouldn't be that surprising that when you have the president of one party talking about voter fraud, that filters down and the voters of that party tend to believe it. But you're right, it's just a belief, but it's based on the rhetoric of the leading figure of that party.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer with us, Sarah Mitchell, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of the program. Before the break, let's get into this. This week, the current President Biden, his cabinet took steps toward completion with the confirmation of a UN ambassador, also an ag secretary. Some other of the top posts remain in some partisan gridlock there in the confirmation hearings. Linda Thomas-Greenfield will become confirmed as a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And yesterday, the U.S. Senate confirmed former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, his nomination as agriculture secretary in the Biden administration. A 92-7 vote places Vilsack back in the office he occupied from 2009 to 2017 under then-President Barack Obama. U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and our other U.S. Senator, Joni Ernst, both Republicans, voted for Vilsack's confirmation. Vilsack, already the second longest-serving U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. Of course, former governor of Iowa, served as governor of this state from 1999 until 2007, a Democrat. Let's listen to him yesterday in the United States Senate talking about the many challenges facing farmers, rural America, in his Senate committee hearing earlier this month.
And it's not lost on me, ironically, that this is Groundhog's Day, and I realize that I'm back again. But I also realize that this is a fundamentally different time, and I am a different person, and it is a different department. And I think we have to recognize that going into this process. I think we are faced today with a number of why not opportunities and moments in agriculture, in the food industry, and in rural America. Clearly, COVID is on the minds of everyone, as it should be. And the Department of Agriculture has a responsibility to aggressively promote the nutrition assistance that you all have provided, and they have begun to do that in the last week to 10 days. We also, as Senator Bozeman indicated, have to review the additional relief that's been ordered by Congress and try to get that into the hands of farmers, ranchers, producers, and those in rural America as quickly, efficiently, as effectively as possible.
Okay, let me hand this to you, Chris. What makes Tom Vilsack, a native of Mount Pleasant, Iowa, such an agreeable, relatively uncontroversial ag secretary, also for Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think in part, you know, he did it. Obviously, he was ag secretary for 8 years, the only cabinet official in the Obama administration to stay for all 8 years. I think he stepped down just that last week of the Obama administration. But, you know, he's from rural Iowa. He's from Iowa, which is a, you know, I think for some Republicans, they may view it as a Republican state, but which I think is, you know, that's another question. But, you know, he has experience in this position. He's relatively uncontroversial in terms of not making a lot of overtly political statements that can sometimes get cabinet nominees in trouble during the confirmation process. And again, I think his experience as a governor of a Midwestern state, his focus on rural interests, as he said there, is something that, you know, lends itself to a relatively easy confirmation process, which these days, how polarized everything is somewhat impressive. And so I think all of that, his experience, his background, his focus on rural interests, and as I said, even when he left during those 4 years during the Trump administration, he was not pursuing necessarily a political gains or overtly political gains. He was relatively behind the scenes with the Dairy Council.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sarah, not much time before the break, but Vilsack, perhaps in comparison to the previous ag secretary under Donald Trump, Sonny Perdue, a Republican from Georgia. Here we have a Democrat from the Midwest replacing him, returning to a post.
Yeah, I mean, I think Vilsack did a good job in the confirmation, you know, answering Senator Ernst's questions about, you know, the Biden administration push for electric cars and how that would affect the Iowa ethanol market. And, you know, he mentioned, right, like that in terms of a broader climate change strategy, we need to think about, you know, ethanol as well, because it the emissions from it are 46% lower than for gasoline. So I think he does a good job of kind of taking a middle position between the parties on some of these important issues.
Okay, we'll be back with more of Politics Wednesday. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, our two political scientists, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about President Biden's pick to lead the Justice Department, Merrick Garland. There's a familiar name. We'll talk about that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Iowa Republican leaders encourage wearing a mask at the Capitol, but oppose making it a mandate.
We have no way to enforce that, even if we were to say everyone in the caucus has to have a mask.
This worries Democratic leaders.
I'm concerned and want to avoid, you know, turning the legislature into a super spreader event.
Legislative leaders share their goals and concerns, and so does the governor on the podcast Under the Golden Dome. Listen to the new episode now at iowapublicradio.org.
We're back with a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with our political scientists today, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, both professors of political science in their respective universities there. A quick correction from last half hour. I think I inadvertently said Tom Vilsack, a native Iowan, actually born in Pennsylvania, former mayor of Mount Pleasant, Iowa. His wife, Christy, is a native Iowan. Apologies for that misstatement there. Thanks to the listeners for making sure we're good with the facts there. Let's talk about confirmation hearings on Monday. President Biden's pick to lead the Justice Department, Merrick Garland, told lawmakers that the investigation into the Capitol insurrection would be a top priority if he is confirmed as Attorney General. Garland also said he wants to look more broadly at the roots of extremism, which groups could pose problems in the future. He has experience dealing with the topic. He oversaw the federal investigation in the Oklahoma City bombing earlier in his career. Garland has won support from Democrats and Republicans thus far. Sarah, comment on this nomination. Merrick Garland, of course, a very familiar name from years past.
Yeah, I think he's done a good job in the hearings and has bipartisan support on track to be nominated. I thought it was interesting that he drew a line from the Oklahoma City bombing to the extremism and white nationalism that we're seeing today, which I thought was interesting. He was also very openly talking about systemic racism, what it is and how it affects communities of color, and talked about, you know, ethnic minorities having lower unemployment, home ownership rates, and ability to accumulate wealth, and talking about it was a contrast to William Barr, who essentially denied that there was any kind of systemic racism in police departments or other judicial settings. So I think that kind of stood out to me, that he was very forthcoming about that. He also was asked about defunding the police and reiterated Biden's position against that he was against that, basically saying that what happened on January 6th shows, you know, why that's a bad idea. So third, I thought, you know, his line that when asked about, you know, the sort of political aspects of how he would work with Biden, I thought he had a really good line where he said, "I'm not the president's lawyer. I am the United States' lawyer." Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a really good statement.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I'd like to have you react with your comments also to what Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said in his opening statement of this confirmation hearing for nominee Merrick Garland. While Grassley believes Garland is qualified for the position, he also raised concerns about the conduct of the Justice Department in recent years and how he does not want similar things repeated under Garland. Let's listen.
No one doubts that Judge Garland is qualified for his job, but of course, Attorney General is more than just qualifications. The top law enforcement officer of the United States must be committed to enforcing the rule of law. What I don't want is a return to the Obama years. I don't want an attorney general who bragged about being a wingman, and those are his words, to the president. That was Eric Holder notoriously describing himself. I don't want a Justice Department that abuses the FISA process to spy on American citizens. I don't want consent decrees that federalize law enforcement and cause murder rates to soar. I don't want a return to catch and release on the border. I could come up with many other examples. Unfortunately, a lot of what we've seen so far from the Justice Department is discouraging.
Okay, comment on that, Chris. Grassley's comments interesting in that clip, especially given the way in which Bill Barr served as Attorney General under President Trump.
It is. I mean, you know, initially, Senator Grassley is referring to, I think, what a lot of people see as the sort of the politicalization of the attorney general position. And people are worried about politics coming into that, because I think a lot of people like to think of, you know, this notion of judicial independence, that when we're talking about the Department of Justice, we are talking about a department that is independent of politics. And of course, the reality is that you really can't escape that. And so I think most people would agree with the notion of desiring judicial independence, but what Senator Grassley seemed to be talking a little bit more about was not just the politics, but particular policies that he disagreed with coming out of the Department of Justice under a Democratic administration. And, you know, I think whatever administration is in control, whether it's Democrat or Republican, the Attorney General is someone who is going to be appointed by the president because of he shares his or her policy views. And so it shouldn't be too surprising that we see an attorney general pursue and advocate for positions that the administration wants. But the other side of it, of course, is that there has to be some balance there with judicial independence. And I think it's just the reality of politics today is that, you know, that even a department where we would like to see complete independence from politics, we're never going to see that. And so I think some of what Senator Grassley there is talking about is just the blending of those two concepts of politics and judicial independence. And, you know, clearly he was frustrated with some of the policies that were coming out of the Obama administration that he disagreed with and that the attorney general was taking a strong position in favor of.
Mm-hmm. The topic of those hearings, that testimony, as mentioned, the January 6th insurrection, we had yesterday testimony before Congress, three former Capitol security officials who resigned after the January 6th riot. They acknowledged they had been unprepared for that attack. They blamed federal officials for not sending help quickly. These three former Capitol security officials, the chief of the Washington, D.C. police, blamed federal law enforcement and the Defense Department for intelligence failures ahead of that riot and for slow authorization of the National Guard as this violence, which nearly all of us witnessed live on television, escalated. Let's listen to a little bit of the Senate committee hearing yesterday. Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Senator Klobuchar, laid out all the questions that must be answered to help create a more secure system at the U.S. Capitol.
To make this place safe going forward, we must answer some key questions. First and foremost, on many of our minds, is what took so long to deploy the National Guard that day, both because of decisions made in the Capitol complex, but also by others in the federal government. We must find out what was known about the potential for violence before the attack and how that intelligence was shared with law enforcement partners, including the officials responsible for protecting the Capitol. There are also important questions to be asked about how information concerning those threats was communicated to rank and file officers. And it's vital that we explore necessary reforms to the structure of the Capitol Police Board, which I know we will hear more about today. We owe it to the 140 Capitol police officers injured and to all those at the Capitol who continue to suffer the repercussions.
Sarah, in the investigation of what happened on January 6th, the lead up to it, Capitol security, an issue here, from what you can tell, being discussed in a less partisan manner, a more productive manner in terms of getting security where we need it to be?
Well, I think it's really important given, you know, when we've seen more of the video footage from what happened during the impeachment trial, you know, we saw how close a lot of members of Congress were to being victims of violence. So I think, you know, having better security procedures is really important just to protect our Capitol and our congressmen. But I think there's a lot of parallels actually to what happened with 9/11 because, you know, one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda was successful in carrying out the 9/11 attack was because we had, you know, intelligence failure in terms of sharing information across, you know, different parts of the FBI or other intelligence agencies. And so I think what was disturbing to me here was the idea that the head of security for the House and Senate were not receiving the reports from the FBI about the threat of violence on January 6th. And so, you know, that those kind of intelligence gaps are what lead to, you know, these kind of situations where a lot of people are injured or killed. And so I think it's really important to get to the bottom of what do we know about how that information was passed along in the chain. We definitely need to know more about the Pentagon's role here in terms of, and the Army in particular, and not authorizing the National Guard more quickly. Mm-hmm. I do think it's a little bit partisan in the sense that, so, you know, each side is kind of saying like, that wasn't me, that was the, you know, that was the other group. So there's a little bit of like blame shifting that's happening in some of these testimonies. But I think it'll be interesting to see when we have more testimony from, you know, people in the Pentagon to kind of get that side of things.
If you've just joined us, Sarah Mitchell, political scientist at the University of Iowa, along with Chris Larimer, likewise, political scientist at the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday, the final 10 minutes or so. On a related issue to what we were just talking about, she's the only Republican leader to vote to impeach former President Trump for inciting the insurrection on Congress. She's not backing down. She is doubling down. Yesterday, during a virtual foreign policy event hosted by the Reagan Institute, Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, Chris and Sarah, I don't know if you followed this. Of course, she's the number three House Republican, called on her party to, in her words, quote, make clear that we aren't the party of white supremacy. She argued that elected Republicans must forcefully condemn those responsible for the January 6th riot. A few of her comments, just to quote them, it's very important for us to ignore the temptation to look away from the attack. It's very important, especially for us as Republicans, to make clear that we aren't the party of white supremacy. You saw symbols of the Holocaust denial, for example, at the Capitol that day. You saw the Confederate flag being carried through the rotunda. And I think we as Republicans in particular have a duty and an obligation to stand against that, to stand against insurrection. How surprising is this coming from Liz Cheney?
Well, I think it depends on how you think about this. I mean, you know, in part, this is being talked about in a way that she's obviously separating herself, as you said, from white supremacists. And I think all elected officials do that and want to do that. But I think some of this also is the way it's being talked about is that, does this mean that she's also trying to separate herself from a base within the Republican Party that was perhaps more inclined to vote for Donald Trump or more inclined to support Donald Trump? And does that mean she then therefore wants to separate herself from Trump supporters generally? And if it's that latter part, then you know, what does that mean for the party going forward? There's an article in today's New York Times by Thomas Edsall, and he's talking about this very issue of where does the party go? And I know you spoke to the chair of the Republican Party yesterday, Chairman Kaufman. Mm-hmm. And talking about, you know, is there really a split here? And what was interesting in the article I mentioned from the New York Times today is that he was talking to a political scientist, Gary Jacobson, out at UC San Diego, and he had done a study looking at asking Republicans how they felt about Donald Trump, how they felt about the Republican Party, and how they felt about Mitch McConnell. And what he found is that while favorability for Republicans and Donald Trump dipped a little bit in December and January of this year, it really dropped off among Republicans for Mitch McConnell. And so there's a question then, if support for Mitch McConnell among Republicans has dropped off considerably than what it has compared to the Republican Party generally or Donald Trump, what does that mean for how candidates want to position themselves for 2022? And people like Liz Cheney or others who are going to be running as Republicans in 2022, what does that mean for how they try to position themselves? How do they try to talk about the former president? How do they try to talk about what happened on January 6th?
Mm-hmm. And Senator Mitt Romney, Republican, weighed in yesterday on the very topic you're talking about, Chris. He said, I don't know if he'll run in 2024 or not, but if he does, speaking of Donald Trump, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination. Sarah, weigh in quickly on this split, which yesterday, Chris, heard the interview. I talked with the Republican head of Iowa Republicans, Jeff Kaufman, denied there's a split. How do you see it?
I think there's absolutely a split that's happening, and you can see it in, you know, Hans Noel, this political scientist, has produced some interesting plots of the votes on the election certification and on impeachment by the percentage of Trump vote in each district. And it's just a straight line that goes upward, right? So the higher the percentage of Trump voters, the more likely that member of Congress was to either vote to not certify the election results or to vote against the impeachment. So I think what happens is even if you are a moderate Republican, if you're existing in a district or a state that has a large percentage of Trump voters, then it's very costly to take a moderate position. And you're seeing this, right, with lots of local Republican parties are censoring people like Liz Cheney. And so the moderates are being censored by the parties at the state level, which have moved to the right. And we see that in the state legislatures as well in terms of the kind of agendas that they're enacting. So mm-hmm. I think it's going to be really difficult to imagine, right, how you're going to bring together this more centrist and this more right wing of the party moving forward in terms of a coherent, unified national policy agenda.
Let's finish this hour with the words of the current president, Joe Biden, on Monday held a memorial service as the United States passed 500,000 deaths during this COVID pandemic. Biden called on people to remember those who have passed by reading their obituaries and to remember them for the life they have lived.
Today we mark a truly grim, heartbreaking milestone. 500,071 dead. That's more Americans who have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. That's more lives lost to this virus than any other nation on Earth. But as we acknowledge the scale of this mass death in America, we remember each person and the life they lived.
Okay. Chris, comment here on not only this grim milestone, but President Biden's first month in office, of course, the pandemic, his number one priority.
Yeah, I mean, it's just astounding and very saddening to hear that number, to think back a year ago when this was all starting, that it would escalate that quickly to get to this point. And with that obviously also what President Biden was saying there clearly, and what we've heard is it's reflective of what his priority is, right? He really is pushing pandemic relief. That's been part of what he has been pushing since day one, since taking the oath of office, is trying to push through pandemic relief, trying to, in addition to working on the $1.9 trillion relief bill that's working its way through Congress, you know, he's doing other things in terms of trying to improve vaccine distribution. He's had, you know, a goal of so many vaccines in his first 100 days, about 100 million vaccines in the first 100 days, and continuing to move that up and trying to coordinate with states in a way that improves that distribution. And so I think, you know, if you're looking at trying to assess his first month or so in office here, you know, it has been focused on the pandemic. And various aspects of the economy related to the pandemic. Obviously, it's moving into the confirmations of his appointees and his cabinet officials. And so far, it's been what we've expected, I think, in terms of trying to move quickly on a number of policy items that he campaigned on. And just today, there was a story in the New York Times talking about he's even down to the language to describing certain issues, for example, with climate change or with immigration. Mm-hmm. They're pushing through things that they've talked about on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm. I guess the final word is to you, Sarah, comment on President Biden's first month in office about his action against this pandemic or otherwise. What stands out for you?
Yeah, well, I guess one thing that stands out to me is, the feeling among at least some Americans that they're not outraged by the number of people that are dead. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're 4% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's COVID deaths. And I saw a statistic that if you filled Greyhound buses, right, the number dead would stretch end to end from Chicago to Milwaukee, or 97 miles. Like, we have to visualize how many people have actually died, and then we have to be outraged about it. And so I am saddened and outraged by it. And I'm glad that we have an administration that is working very hard to tackle this virus. And they've increased vaccine distribution by 46% just in the last 5 weeks to the states, including Iowa, which got a boost, I think, of like 17,000 dosages per, I don't know if it was per week or per month. But that makes me feel good as a person who, like everyone else, wants to get back to a normal life. And so,
right.
So I'm glad to see that he had this goal of 100 million vaccines in 100 days, but it looks like he'll exceed that given the policies that his administration is pursuing.
Sarah, in a few seconds, what about President Biden's campaign pledge of unity? How has that turned out in practice so far?
I mean, I think given that if you look at the data, we are the most polarized politically that we've ever been in, at least in recent decades. So it's not surprising to me that the calls for unity were going to be followed by some difficult votes and some political bickering over these kind of bills. I guess that's what my cynical bias would have predicted, or cynical prior, maybe what I should call it.
Yeah. All right. Very good. We have to go now. Sarah Mitchell, thank you very much. The F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks to you both and to listeners for their input.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.